Hi, my name is Alex Goldappel, and you're listening to The Weekly on Beyond the Headlines. Earlier this year, the Ontario government announced changes to the province's OSAP program. These changes include an elimination of free tuition through grants for low-income students, a decrease in the maximum income eligibility threshold to be eligible for OSAP, a change in the balance of grants and loans available, with a reduction in the percentage of grants, and the elimination of the six-month interest-free period following graduation. I spoke to Andrew Parkin, director of the Mowat Centre and an expert on education policy, on the effect that these changes will have on low-income students in Ontario. This interview was recorded before the 2019 Ontario budget was released, so any developments from the budget are not reflected in the interview. So I'm here with Andrew Parkin, director of the Mowat Centre. First of all, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been close to 2 months since the Ontario government announced changes to the funding of post-secondary education in Ontario. I just want to get your first initial reaction. What are the impacts of those changes?
Well, they're going to wash out differently for different sectors. So we can talk about the impact of the change to the student grant program, and that's really an impact on those who need student financial assistance. There's an impact across the whole student body of a rollback in tuition. And that will, benefit anyone who pays tuition that happens to be students who aren't on the student grant programs, because student grants cover tuition, so it's mostly everyone else. And there's an impact on institutions because the tuition is part of the funding for institutions and it's not being replaced. So different impacts on kind of the different constituencies. But I think the, to kind of get to the heart of the conversation, the most interesting part is, what is the impact on OSAP recipients, which in particular are on students from lower income families, who are really the whole focus of an access strategy, right? If the goal is to improve access to post-secondary education, to make that more equitable, that's the one of the key groups that we're focusing on. And the impact on that is, I think, going to be a longer-term issue, and we can talk a little bit about that, because I think the original purpose of the free tuition program that the previous government brought in was also to have an impact that was going to be more long-term and take time to work its way through the system.
Speaking about low-income Ontarians, some of your prior research has looked at early interventions for students and looked at the successfulness of those early interventions to actually encourage students to further pursue post-secondary education. Do you think that the changes to the grants, to tuition, and to eligibility will have an impact?
So there's a chance that they might not, at least might not have an adverse impact on the lowest income students. And I'll talk a little bit about why. The whole thinking behind the idea of providing more grants more clearly, more visibly to students is partly based on the understanding that it took some time to develop, but the understanding that the reasons why students from lower income families are less likely to go to university in particular, or college and university more generally, it is not simply because of a lack of cash in their hands or in their pockets at the moment where they need to pay tuition. It's because of a number of compounding factors that come out of, the effects of low income or the effects of poverty, if you want to phrase it that way, and which affects things that happen much earlier than that, that point of transition from high school into post-secondary education. So it affects their ambitions, their motivation, their preparation, the information that they have. All of these things are kind of social and cultural capital, right? So part of the idea, and it's been an evolution, the free tuition program that came in 17 and 18 was only the kind of last block in a gradual change in OSAP that goes back to Bob Rae's report that came out in 2004, I think, and that pushed towards a better access strategy. So this has been brewing for some time. And the real point was to make the existence of grants predictable and visible, so that if you knew roughly what your parents' income, you didn't even have to make an application, you didn't have to fill out a piece of paper, you didn't have to go online and put a whole bunch of information in some kind of online portal. You knew right away that you were going to get $4,000 a year, $2,000 a year, $6,000, whatever it was. So that when you think about post-secondary education, you can always think about it as being affordable in the sense that you're either paying no tuition or half tuition or whatever. And that was different from how grants used to work. Grants used to work through a complex system of need assessment where you had to provide a whole bunch of information about what course you were studying and where you were living and whether you had a car or didn't have a car. And, you know, every year your grant would come at the end after you paid all the money, and then they might give you some back. And that didn't help anyone visualize their future in post-secondary education. So really what we were trying to do is provide a signal to students, particularly from the lowest income backgrounds, that in your case, you're going to get this much cash, and that is either going to take care of all or most of tuition for you. It's possible that that part of the system might remain in place, even if fewer students will actually qualify for the maximum grant.
So you sort of just alluded to it prior to the changes. It was possible for a low-income student to be 100% funded through grants, and that no longer exists. Now there will be some aspect of that that is loans. I believe the maximum contribution is about 83% in grants. Will that affect signaling? Will that affect how people make decisions?
It doesn't have to. And this, I'm going to focus on the kind of architecture more than the amount of money, right? And this I'll kind of go back a little bit to the Auditor General's report that was tabled just a couple months before the new government announced its plan, but provided some of the rationale for the change. And the Auditor General kind of said two things, and one of them made sense and one of them didn't make sense. And the one that made sense is that it turned out in the first year of the program was costing the government much more money than had been estimated. And that's mostly because a number of students who were already in the system opted in, essentially, decided they weren't previously on OSEP. They decided to go on OSEP for good reason because there was a benefit available. And that hadn't really been factored in the costing. And also because the grants kind of tailed off. So as your family income or as family income of students rose, they could get some grants, maybe not the maximum amount, but they're still getting some grants. And the cutoff of that was pretty high, right? It was really up in the middle, upper income range. And there are very few people, I think, who looked at that the first time around and thought that that made sense. So there was always a sense that the program was probably designed a bit on the over-generous side. So when the Auditor General came back after the first year and said, look, now we have a first year of numbers and this is, you know, a little bit bursting at the seams kind of thing, the idea that a new government might want to adjust the eligibility threshold does not, you know, kind of make, you know, make sense, right? Target the best money to the students who need it most. What the Auditor General said that didn't make any sense is the Auditor General said the program wasn't working. And said it wasn't working because it didn't boost enrollment after 1 year. And to say that is just silly because that you're essentially saying that adjusting OSEP regulations is going to somehow have a profound effect on students who are already at the grade 12, who have already more or less completed their applications, chosen all their electives, you know, to put in my language, have already imagined their future, and somehow they're going to change on a dime. The idea of being much more clear about affordability, about what's there to pay if your family doesn't have the means to pay, that's going to affect students starting at maybe starting in grade 7, starting at age 12, maybe earlier for some, right? Where the whole talking about post-secondary education in the family, in the school, starts to change because everyone can clearly say, if you have the marks to go, doesn't matter what your family income is, there will be this much grant. And the Auditor General missed that. I just totally missed that was the rationale of the program. And so that was unfortunate because it created this impression, you know, that the program somehow didn't deliver, where it's way too early to tell. So again, if the architecture is kept so that, again, a high school teacher now can look at a grade 7 student and say, I can tell you right now what your aid package is going to be if you go through all of these years of high school, do well, and want to go on. If that stays in place, that's more important than, I would say, the adjustment of the eligibility.
You mentioned the threshold, and the maximum threshold was lowered from $175,000 a year to $140,000 a year in family income.
you don't think that that will have maybe as big an impact as some people are predicting?
Impact on what? Impact on accessibility? To be honest, it shouldn't. Now, this may sound harsh, and I'm not trying to do that. Anyone who receives a benefit, it's good to receive that benefit, and it will impact them negatively if they no longer receive that benefit. But if you stand back a little bit and look at the entire system and say, is the access problem that we have in Ontario, is it around people from families making $150,000? I think you would have to conclude mm-hmm. that overall, no, that's not where the bigger, much, much bigger access issues around students with disabilities, students from Indigenous backgrounds, and low-income students. And by low-income, we're talking, you know, students with family income, $60,000, $50,000, $75,000, and so on, and lower. So again, you know, I wouldn't want to be cornered to say, like, no one can never imagine anyone being adversely impacted. It's better to have money than not to have money.
Right.
But in terms of managing an overall system, that's not the adjustment of that eligibility threshold down a little bit is I think not as important as keeping the signaling and the clarity in place. I think the only risk is a little bit of this sort of transition period can mix up that messaging, right? Because now people might start thinking, well, there were grants, but they were canceled. Well, no, that's not true.
Right.
There's still grants in the system and so on. So it might take a little while to kind of get everyone back on message and, you know, get that situation that I was trying to describe where high school teachers can talk to 12-year-olds right now and say, for you, money shouldn't be an object.
This is maybe independent of the recent changes and probably is something that all governments in Ontario have to deal with. But do you think that the Ministry of Education and governments in Ontario do enough to signal to parents and to young children in those early stages?
So that's an interesting question. And because, first of all, it's always easy to say they're not doing enough. No one, you know, if there's more to do, then someone's not doing enough. I think one of the questions is how good is government ever going to be at being the main messenger on that? So who do teenagers listen to? Probably not governments. They listen to their parents, and their parents might, people don't think teenagers listen to their parents. They may not follow everything their parents say, but that's still the big source of information, right? People accumulate information in their families, among their friends, in their social networks. So government may impact the information that families have, but I think it's really a shared responsibility across the whole system. Teachers, admissions officers, people who go to education fairs from universities and colleges and talk about why you should come to their university and college should also be able to tell you, you know, whether you're going to have to pay to come or not. So I think it's a responsibility of government to make sure that, you know, there's clear, consistent information and is widely shared. I think it's expecting a bit too much of government to be the main agent that sort of convinces young people about, you know, how they're going to plan their future, because that's just not what we turn to governments for.
Outside of the 10% reduction in tuition and the changes to accessibility for OSAP grants, there were a few other policy changes announced, including the elimination of the 6-month grace period for loan repayment after graduation and the extension of the categorization of independent students from 4 to 6 years. Did either of those two policies send any red flags about access for lower income students?
Again, it's awkward to be in the position of sort of saying you can take money away from people and it's fine. The grace period can be helpful. We know that students are taking longer to transition into a steady job after graduation than they used to, and which doesn't mean that they're not getting where they need to go. Outcomes are still really good from post-secondary education. It's just the current cohort it's taking a bit longer. So the grace period was helpful in that. But whether it was the most, you know, it's all a question of if you have so many dollars, what's the most effective use of one? But I would say the grace, you know, in a context where the economy is a bit more challenging for that transition, the grace period could be one thing that could help. But the independent one, I think that's a tough one. And there may be some people who are more qualified to talk about it than I am. But it is one of those things where the kind of general rule has so many exceptions around it. So just to remind people, you know, the issue is the OSAP system treats you as being dependent on your parents, therefore they need to know your parents' income until you were, I think, previously 4 years out. So you could be from a high-income family and you get to your fifth year out of high school and suddenly it's like you have no family income behind you at all and so on. So that, you know, to a certain extent doesn't seem fair. But there are many people who are 22, 23 years over their own, who are struggling on their own, who don't have parental support. Even if their parents do have healthy incomes, they may not be spending any of that to support their children. And so I think this is one of those cases where it's really hard to design a system because you really want to treat every case as an individual case, and bureaucracies don't do that. So that's maybe the most intelligent thing I can say around it. Again, I think there's experts inside the system who are better placed to comment than I am. But I think the issue is there's always going to be some cases that don't fit the model.
I'm just going to ask one last question about what you see as the future of the OSAP program going forward.
I think I can answer it a little bit, I think, but I might repeat what I said, which is
the structure.
Leave it alone for a while. The key to a certain extent, agree on what's going to be going forward and then leave it alone. I would continue to say that one of the key points is to make sure it's integrated with the admission system. The most exciting development over the last couple of years is the movement to a system where you can get a letter of offer from a university and college that also tells you that you're going to qualify for enough grants that you're either not going to pay tuition at all or only going to pay a fraction of tuition. And that was what was missing. As I've told a number of people, there were programs that were brought in 2005 that effectively made college education in Ontario free for low-income students, essentially paid for 3 out of 4 terms of a two-year program. But there was no college system, college student who knew that because it was never communicated that way. And so in terms of thinking of the future, if we can keep that piece so that, you know, the recruitment and admissions and the financial aid is working together in one message, that would be awesome. And then apart from that, I think, you know, resist the urge to tinker with it each and every budget, each and every year, in such a way that makes it harder and harder for people to give students a straight answer.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Once again, that was Andrew Parkin, director of the Mowat Center, speaking about the changes to Ontario's OSAP program. I'm joined now in the studio by the outgoing executive directors of Beyond the Headlines, Neri Kim and Dimitri Chehalis, as well as my incoming co-executive director, Vienna Ventitelli. My interview with Andrew Parkin was recorded before the Mowat Center unfortunately announced that they were closing due to the elimination of their funding by the Ontario government. On behalf of the entire Beyond the Headlines team, we want to thank the Mowat Center for their collaboration over the past years.
One of the great benefits of having a relationship with the Mowat Center over these years was an accessibility to their staff and the willingness, and always an overwhelming amount of willingness from their director and professor to us, Dr. Andrew Parkin, to be on our panel. Mm-hmm. So I know Nuri and I had a great time working with him and hearing all he had to say on public policy topics leading up to the upcoming 2019 federal election, which was very exciting. They were really Ontario's voice for objective and evidence-based public policy discussions and trying to bring in expertise from inside and outside of government as well. And I've been using their reports for projects on countless things. And if it wasn't for some of the great integrated professionals that they had, we wouldn't have had half of the great discussions and interviews that we've had, like the one that you had today with Andrew Parkin. So I just want to say thank you.
I agree. The Mowat Center has been an integral part of the School of Public Policy and Governance before the amalgamation and now part of the Monk School, and we're really sad to see it go. We really enjoyed having Dr. Andrew Parkin on our panel discussion event, as well as a few of our episodes, and Mowat Center was really truly Ontario's voice for evidence-based public policy, and I'm sure a lot of students have used their reports in their papers and to nuance their education with the findings from Mowat Center. That's truly a big loss to the public policy community.
Yes, definitely. I know when I worked in the OPS, everyone was looking to their reports to help inform any decisions that they were going to make.
I also just wanted to say thank you to the Mowat Center. I had the privilege of being taught by Andrew Parkin this semester in the MPP social context class. The engaging discussions that he helped lead helped all of us here at the Monk School. So I just wanted to say thank you to Andrew Parkin.
Yeah, and I think more than ever, this just reminds us that evidence-based policy discussion and exploration is important now, you know, with not just the Mowat Center recently closing, but other institutes in the province. It shows the role and the importance of program like Beyond the Headlines to continue this evidence-based conversation going forward next year and for years to come. So I think we take that seriously, and we hope to carry on and do a little bit of justice to the amazing work that some of these organizations have done in the past. That concludes Beyond the Headlines for the 2018-2019 year. Thank you to our outgoing directors once again, Dimitri Chalice and Neri Kim. We will continue with some programming throughout the summer and return with regularly scheduled episodes and, of course, the weekly in the 2019-2020 year.
Can't wait.
Woo! Incredible.